As benzodiazepine sales grew through the 1960s and 1970s, so did the backlash against them. Some doctors warned that the drugs were being overprescribed. In 1973, Leo Hollister, a psychiatrist at Stanford, mused whether the increase in the use of anti-anxiety agents is the result of the generally turbulent times which have prevailed in the past decade, or the introduction of new drugs and their widespread promotion, or of sloppy prescribing practices of physicians, is uncertain. If 18% of doctors were themselves taking Valium, that might account for some of the sloppiness. By the middle of the 1970s, the FDA had collected numerous reports of benzodiazepine dependence. Many patients who had been on high dosages of Valium or Librium for long periods of time would experience excruciating physical and psychological symptoms when they stopped taking the medication: anxiety, insomnia, headaches, tremors, blurred vision, ringing in the ears, the feeling that insects were crawling all over them, and extreme depression, and, in some cases, seizures, convulsions, hallucinations, and paranoid delusions. By the time Ted Kennedy led the 1979 Senate hearings on the hazards of benzodiazepines, critics had a rich literature of horror stories to draw on. Judy Garland's death, among others, was attributed to a toxic combination of benzodiazepines and alcohol. Fears about benzodiazepine were given a broad airing by Barbara Gordon, a star television writer at CBS who had been nearly destroyed by addiction to Valium. Gordon's experience with benzodiazepine dependence, as recounted in her memoir, I'm Dancing as Fast as I Can, resonated widely. The book became a New York Times bestseller in 1979 and a feature film starring Jill Clayburgh in 1982. That was the year Public Citizen, the organization led by the consumer advocate Ralph Nader, published Stopping Valium, which alleged rampant benzodiazepine addiction. Social critics worried that the rampant prescription of Valium was papering over the rough edges of society, medicating away radicalism, dissent, and creativity. One must consider the broader implications of a culture in which tens of millions of adult citizens have come to use psychoactive drugs to alter virtually every facet of their waking and sleeping behavior, warned one doctor at a 1971 academic conference on drug use. What does that say about the impact of modern technology on our style of life? What changes may be evolving in our value system? Feminists had related concerns. A series of ads run by Roche in the early 1970s presumed to offer a treatment for spinsterhood. 35, single and psychoneurotic, began a typical full-page advertisement, this one telling the sad story of Jan. "You probably see many Jans in your practice," the ad went on. "The unmarrieds with low self-esteem. Jan never found a man to measure up to her father. Now she realizes she's in a losing pattern and that she may never marry. The cure? Valium. You wake up in the morning and you feel as if there's no point in going on another day like this," Betty Friedan had written in 1963 in The Feminine Mystique. "So you take a tranquilizer because it makes you not care so much that it's pointless." Marxist intellectuals like Herbert Marcuse attributed widespread pill-popping to capitalist alienation. Conspiracy theorists invoked Aldous Huxley's dystopian Brave New World, alleging that the government was exerting social control by tranquilizing the masses, which was ironic because Huxley himself was an enthusiastic promoter of tranquilizers. An editorial published in the prestigious British medical journal The Lancet in 1973 fretted that at current rates of Valium use, which up to that point had been growing at a clip of 7 million prescriptions a year, the arrival of the millennium would coincide with the total tranquilization of America. As it turned out, Valium use peaked in 1973. The looming expiration of Valium's patent in 1985 helped spur the rise of a new benzodiazepine, alprazolam, which the Upjohn Company released with the trade name Xanax in 1981. entering the market just after the DSM-3 had introduced anxiety disorders as a clinical category. Xanax got a huge commercial boost from being the first drug specifically approved by the FDA for the treatment of the newly created panic disorder. This approval was not without controversy. The first favorable studies of Xanax's effect on panic were published in the Archives of General Psychiatry, whose editor at the time, Daniel Friedman, turned out to be on Upjohn's payroll as a member of its Division of Medical Affairs. Critics said this had unduly biased him and that the studies should not have been published because they were poorly constructed and therefore did not actually demonstrate that the drug was effective. Many patients, and before long I was one of them, found that Xanax cut down on panic attacks and reduced physical symptoms like dizziness, palpitations, and gastrointestinal distress, as well as psychological ones like excessive timidity and feelings of dread. The poet Marie Howe once told a friend of mine who was afraid to fly after 9/11, "You know that little door in your brain marked fear? Xanax closes it." By 1986, Xanax had overtaken Miltown, Librium, and Valium to become the best-selling drug in history. It has dominated the tranquilizer market ever since. In 2010, Xanax was the 12th most commonly prescribed drug in America and the most frequently prescribed psychotropic medication, more widely prescribed than Prozac or any other single antidepressant. Anxiety and tension seem to abound in our modern culture, and the current trend is to escape the unpleasantness of its impact. But when has life ever been exempt from stress? In the long run, is it desirable that a population be ever free from tension? Should there be a pill for every mood and occasion? From a December 1956 report by the New York Academy of Medicine. Benzodiazepines have been a leading pharmaceutical treatment for anxiety for more than half a century. But not until the late 1970s did the Italian neuroscientist Erminio Costa, yet another veteran of Steve Brody's lab at the National Institutes of Health, finally home in on their salient chemical mechanism, their effect on a neurotransmitter called gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA, which inhibits the rate at which neurons fire. Some brief and oversimplified neuroscience. A neurotransmitter called glutamate excites neurons, causing them to fire more rapidly. GABA, on the other hand, inhibits neurons, slowing their firing and calming brain activity. If glutamate is the main accelerator of the brain circuitry, GABA is the main brake. Costa discovered that benzodiazepines bind to GABA receptors found on every neuron, amplifying GABA's inhibitory effects and suppressing activity of the central nervous system. In binding to the GABA receptors, benzodiazepines change the receptor's molecular structure in a way that causes the GABA signal to last longer, which in turn causes the neuron to continue firing at a lower rate, calming brain activity. Knowing even this superficial bit of neuroscience has given me a serviceable metaphor for understanding how my brain produces anxiety, and how Xanax reduces it. When my anxiety mounts, my autonomic nervous system gets kicked into fight-or-flight mode. My thoughts start racing, and I start imagining all kinds of catastrophic things. My body feels like it's going haywire. I imagine the firing of my synapses getting faster and faster, like an overheating engine. I take a Xanax, and about 30 minutes later, if I'm lucky, I can almost feel the GABA system putting on the brakes as the benzodiazepines bind to their receptors and inhibit neuronal firing. Everything slows down. Of course, this is a rather reductionist metaphor. Can my anxiety really be boiled down to how effectively gated my chloride ion channels are, or to the speed of neuronal firing in my amygdala? Well, yes, at some level it can. Rates of neuronal firing in the amygdala correlate quite directly with the felt experience of anxiety. But to say that my anxiety is reducible to the ions in my amygdala is as limiting as saying that my personality or my soul is reducible to the molecules that make up my brain cells or to the genes that underwrote them. In any case, I have a more practical concern. What is this long-term reliance on benzodiazepines doing to my brain? By this point, I have taken benzodiazepines, Valium, Klonopin, Ativan, Xanax, at varying doses and frequencies for more than 30 years. For several years during that time, I have been on tranquilizers around the clock for months at a time. Valium, Librium, and other drugs of that class cause damage to the brain. I have seen damage to the cerebral cortex that I believe is due to the use of these drugs, and I am beginning to wonder if the damage is permanent. David Knott, a physician at the University of Tennessee, warned back in 1976. In the 3 decades since then, scores of articles in scientific journals have reported on the cognitive impairment observed in long-term benzodiazepine users. A 1984 study by Malcolm Lader found that the brains of people who took tranquilizers for a long time physically shrank. Subsequent studies have shown that different benzodiazepines seem to concentrate the shrinkage in different parts of the brain. Does this explain why at the age of 44, after several decades of intermittently continuous tranquilizer consumption, I feel stupider than I used to? Chapter 7. Medication and the Meaning of Anxiety. When Valium came along, both patients and their doctors were willing to define their problems in terms of anxiety. When Prozac, a drug for depression, arrived on the scene, the accent fell on depression as the hallmark of distress. Edward Shorter, A History of Psychiatry, 1997. In the spring of 1997, after a difficult year, my parents' divorce, an unhappy job situation, a bad romance, and some months off psychiatric medications, I began, at my therapist's urging, to take Paxil, an SSRI whose generic name is paroxetine. After a week or so on Paxil, I experienced an infusion of energy that bordered on manic. I slept fewer and fewer hours, but without feeling tired during the day. I could, for the first time in my life, regularly awake in the morning, feeling energetic. The mild mania passed, but what followed was a slow brightening of my mood. I ended, finally, after several unsuccessful attempts, my codependent and dysfunctional relationship with my girlfriend of nearly 2 years. I got a promotion at the small magazine where I was working. I started dating. At some point that fall, I realized I had not experienced a full-blown panic attack since I'd started on Paxil in April, by far my longest such stretch since middle school. I was experiencing less anxiety, feeling productive and engaged in my work, and enjoying an active social life. My stomach settled. Paxil was magic. Or was it? Because what was cause and what was effect? That promotion I got at work came along after someone left and I was elevated to fill the position. That would likely have happened even if I hadn't gone on Paxil. Maybe that small boost in my professional status, along with the more interesting and empowering day-to-day responsibilities of the job, bolstered my self-esteem, which in turn gave me the confidence to start sending out freelance work, which in turn made me feel professionally engaged. And while I felt like the Paxil had somehow given me the strength to finally break the stubborn cord of neurotic codependence that had tied me to my girlfriend, maybe I would have done that anyway. And there is no question that, Paxil or no Paxil, being out of that relationship was liberating. For her, too, I'm sure. We haven't spoken since. So maybe it was the particular constellation of events that came together that spring, the promotion, the breaking off of a dysfunctional relationship, the end of a dark Boston winter and the arrival of spring, that lifted my anxiety and depression. Maybe Paxil had nothing to do with it. But I think it did. Beginning with that brief manic boost, my lived experience felt like it was Paxil inflected, and I now know that my clinical trajectory, mild mania, lifting of mood, effecting of positive life changes, is a fairly common one. Of course, another possibility is that what I enjoyed that spring and summer was the placebo effect. The Paxil worked because I believed it would work. With the placebo effect, the power of belief itself, rather than the chemical content of any medication, is the salient mechanism. But the Paxil was not magic. Or if it was, its magic ran out. Because after trundling merrily along in medicated contentment for 10 months, my short-lived feeling of invulnerability was punctured within a period of 10 minutes. In those first months on Paxil, I had, for the first time in 20 years, been able to fly with only moderate anxiety. So one February morning, I drove heedlessly through a fierce New England rainstorm to the airport. How nice not to be in a nervous swivet for days before every plane ride. Boarded my flight, and settled in with my newspaper for the hour-long trip to Washington, D.C. I can't say that I was ever, even in those glorious early days on Paxil, free of flying anxiety. But it was a gentler experience, manifesting itself as butterflies in my stomach, sweat on my palms, and a mild feeling of apprehension, what I imagine many people feel upon takeoff. So there I sat, 28 years old, feeling relatively competent and grown up. Here I am, I thought, the executive editor of a magazine, flying to Washington on business, reading my New York Times. Confidently insulated from terror by my morning dose of 20 milligrams of Paxil, that little pink pill that had kept me panic-free for a blissful few months, as we taxied and took off. And then, passing through the dark clouds that were producing the rainstorm below, we ran into turbulence. It lasted all of 10 minutes, 15 at most. But the whole time I was convinced we were going to crash, or worse, that I would get airsick and throw up. Hands shaking, I gulped 2 Dramamine. Beverage service had been suspended. The flight attendants had been asked to stay seated, which terrified me. But as I looked around the cabin, none of my fellow passengers seemed unduly perturbed. To my left, a man tried to read his newspaper, despite the thrashing and dipping of the plane. To my right, across the aisle, a woman appeared to doze. I, meanwhile, wanted to scream. I desperately wanted the turbulence to end. Please, God, please make it end now, and I'll believe in you and be good and pious forever, and the Dramamine to take effect, and I craved, above all, unconsciousness, an end to the misery. Of course, my fears of crashing must not have been completely consuming, because I had, even in that moment, an additional worry. Was my panic so obvious that the other passengers would see it? Logically, one anxiety should have canceled out the other. If we were all going to die, I shouldn't have been worried about an ephemeral moment of earthly embarrassment before plunging into eternal oblivion, right? On the other hand, if I was going to end up embarrassed after the flight, that would mean we weren't going to die, right? And at that moment, to be safely on the ground and to not be dead, no matter how embarrassed, was a condition greatly to be desired. But in my amygdala-controlled brain, with my sympathetic nervous system on full alert, there was no room for such clarity of logic. All I could think was, I'm going to throw up, and I'm going to be humiliated, and I'm going to die, and I'm terrified, and all I want is to be out of this situation and never to get on a plane again. Then we passed above the clouds, and there was clear sky and sun outside the window, and the ride was completely smooth. The seatbelt sign was turned off. Beverage service resumed. My parasympathetic nervous system kicked in, arresting the firing rate of the hyperactive neurons in my turbocharged amygdala, and I sank into a relieved, Dramamine-enhanced exhaustion. Half an hour or so later, we landed uneventfully in Washington. but the Paxil had stopped working. Not completely, at least not right away. But the illusion of being surrounded by an invincible, anxiety-repelling Paxil force field had been dispelled. This, I now know, is not an infrequent occurrence. Certain SSRI medications can reduce anxiety and cut down on panic attacks, but according to the stress diathesis model of panic, strong stimuli, like a turbulent flight, are potent enough to break through even medication-adjusted brain chemistry to produce intense anxiety. And this can be because of the effect the breakthrough has on the thinking, or the cognitions, of the individual, like a magical spell being broken. Other times, certain drugs just stop working, without such stressful provocation. This phenomenon has been called the Prozac poop-out. After that day, my general anxiety level slowly rose again. My panic attacks began to recur, mild and infrequent at first, then more severe and more often. My flying phobia resurged. I needed to take a large dose of Xanax or Clonopin or Ativan before getting on any flight, and sometimes even that wasn't enough. On my first airplane trip with Susanna, who was later to become my wife, my anxiety got so bad soon after takeoff that I began shaking and gasping frantically. And then, as Susanna looked on in bewilderment, my stomach cramped and I lost control of my bowels. I had planned the trip, 3 days in London, as a romantic vacation, an attempt to woo and impress her. This was not a good start. Nor was the rest of the trip much better. Those parts of the vacation that I did not spend sedated into near catatonia by massive quantities of Xanax, I spent quaking in mortal dread of the return flight. I kept taking Paxil for several years, even after it had lost its panic-repelling magic, out of a combination of inertia and the fear of what might happen if I stopped. But by the spring of 2003, I had been on Paxil for 6 years, and my anxiety was once again in full bloom. It was time to try something new. This is what prompted me to see Dr. Harvard, the psychopharmacologist. During my first visit, he was taking my case history when, as if to demonstrate my disorder, I had a florid panic attack that rendered me breathless and tearful, unable to continue. "Take your time," Dr. Harvard said. "Continue when you're ready." Whether it was the facts of my case history or the vividness of the panic attack I unwillingly displayed for him, Dr. Harvard seemed surprised to learn that I had gone completely unmedicated for stretches of my life. He seemed amazed. To him, I was a hard case, not equipped for normal human functioning without pharmaceutical assistance. We discussed the pharmacological options, eventually settling on Effexor, the trade name for venlaxophine, a serotonin-norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, SNRI, which impedes the absorption and therefore boosts the intrasynaptic levels of both serotonin and norepinephrine in the brain. We talked about how to taper slowly off the Paxil, which I did, carefully following his instructions, decreasing the dosage bit by tiny bit over a period of several weeks. Over the years, I had from time to time considered trying to wean myself off psychiatric medication completely. After all, I reasoned, I'm pretty anxious on medication. How much worse can I be off of it? So once I finally did manage to taper most of the way off the Paxil, I thought, why not? Let's try flying solo for a while. No more drugs. I stopped taking the Paxil and didn't start the Effexor. Here is what you don't see in those TV and magazine advertisements for psychotropic drugs, or even, with any real specificity or sympathetic understanding, in the clinical literature. The hell of going off them. I've never taken heroin, so I can't say whether this is true. I suspect it isn't. But many people claim that withdrawal from Paxil is as bad as withdrawal from heroin. The headaches, the exhaustion, the nausea and stomach cramps, the knee-buckling vertigo, the electric zapping sensation in your brain, a weird but common symptom. And, of course, the surge of anxiety, waking up at dawn every morning to a pounding heart and terrible dread, multiple panic attacks daily. Despite my desire to try to be myself and function without pharmacological assistance for the first time in 6 years, I couldn't hack it. And so one morning, after barely a week off the Paxil, I took my first dose of Effexor. Within minutes, literally, I felt much better. The physical symptoms receded. My state of mind improved. This cannot actually have been due to the Effexor's therapeutic action. SSRIs and SNRIs generally need several weeks to build up in the synapses enough to start working. More likely, something in the Effexor somehow alleviated the effects of chemical withdrawal from Paxil. But what is cause and what is effect? Were the emotional anxiety and physical misery I felt after going off the Paxil really the effect of chemical withdrawal? Or was this simply what it feels like to be me undrugged? After all, I had been on psychiatric medication for long enough that maybe I had forgotten what it feels like to live in my naked brain. Or was my misery that spring less the result of ill-fated drug-switching experiments than of the stress in my life? Two dates loomed at the end of that summer. The first was the deadline for the delivery of the manuscript of my first book, which by then had been in gestation for 6 years, roughly the length of time I'd been on Paxil, and had endured a harrowing journey from editor to editor and publishing house to publishing house through the descent into Alzheimer's of my biography's subject and the increasingly intrusive involvement of my subject's powerful family to get to this point. The other was my wife's due date for the delivery of our first child. The birth of a child ranks high on the famous Holmes and Rahe stress scale, which attempts to quantify the effects of various kinds of life stresses on mental and physical health. Of the difficulties I endured that summer, it's hard to know exactly which were a response to external stressors and which were drug-related. And of those drug-related difficulties, it's hard to know which were withdrawal effects from drugs I was weaning off and which were side effects from drugs I was going on. The contrast between what the pharmaceutical industry's promotional materials and the clinical research papers, many of them subsidized by grants from the pharmaceutical industry, say, and what the roiling online communities of actual patients say, is large. I believe both sides are generally honest and accurate as far as they go. The drugs can have measurable therapeutic benefits. The side effects and withdrawal symptoms can be awful. But neither one is wholly trustworthy. The drug companies and the doctors subsidized by them have a profit-motivated interest in pushing pills. The drug takers are pretty much by definition an unhappy and unstable bunch, prone, like me, to being easily thrown by physical symptoms. Studies have shown that people who score high on scales of anxiety sensitivity tend to suffer drug side effects more severely. A bunch of non-anxious people who took an SSRI would likely be much less bothered by any side effects and would therefore be less likely to complain about them in online forums. So the anti-drug rants of the pill-popping community cannot be taken at face value any more than can the assessment of side effects and withdrawal symptoms in the sometimes boosterish clinical literature. Though the Effexor eased what seemed to be the physical symptoms of my withdrawal from Paxil, my anxiety and panic persisted, and then increased. When I told Dr. Harvard about this, his response, as the response of psychiatrists and psychopharmacologists so often tends to be, was, "We need to elevate your dosage." The quantity of Effexor I was taking was not sufficient, he said, to correct the chemical imbalance in my serotonergic and noradrenergic systems. So I went from taking 37.5 milligrams to 75 milligrams of Effexor 3 times a day, at which point my anxiety levels shot through the roof. At night, I would awaken in the grip of a raging panic attack. During the day, I was having multiple panic attacks, and even when I wasn't having one, I felt as though I were about to. Never had I felt such chronic, persistent agitation. I couldn't stop moving and twitching, couldn't bear the feeling of being in my own skin. The clinical term for this is akathisia. Glimmerings of suicide began twinkling at the edge of my consciousness. I called Dr. Harvard. "I can't take it," I told him. "I think maybe I need to get off the Effexor. I feel like I'm going crazy." "You need to give it more time," he said. And he gave me a prescription for Xanax, which he said would take the edge off my anxiety while giving the Effexor time to work. Prescribing a benzodiazepine, like Xanax, to overcome the anxiety produced when a patient starts taking an antidepressant SSRI or SNRI, like Effexor, has been standard practice since the late 1990s. And in my case, this worked, a little, for a short time. My anxiety receded somewhat, and the panic subsided, but only if I faithfully took my Xanax around the clock. To work on my book, I had rented a decrepit office on the 3rd floor of a crummy building in Boston's North End, and to hasten my progress, I had hired a research assistant, Kathy, who shared the space with me. Kathy was an excellent researcher and, when I wasn't feeling panicky, delightful company. But I was embarrassed about my anxiety and felt I had to hide it, which meant leaving when I felt panic coming on. So I was forever contriving errands to get me out of the office. Often, escaping the office wasn't enough to stem the tide of panic, so I took to walking several blocks to Old North Church, where Paul Revere's famous 1 if by land and 2 if by sea lanterns had supposedly been hung in 1775. I'd sit in an austere wooden pew in the back and gaze at the oil painting of Jesus that hangs behind the altar. In that painting, Christ's face looks kindly, his eyes sympathetic. I am not a hardcore atheist, but nor am I a believer. I'm a who-knows-what-explains-all-this agnostic, a skeptic who, out of my usual abundance of caution, refuses to brazenly deny that God exists for fear of losing Pascal's wager and discovering too late that he does. Yet in those desperate weeks in the summer of 2003, I would sit in Old North Church and pray forthrightly to that painting of Jesus. I'd ask it to please give me peace of mind, or a sign that God existed, something I could grab hold of to steady myself against the assault of my nerves. In my quest for succor, I started reading my way through the Bible and a history of early Christianity, trying to see if I could somehow reason my way to faith and the psychic and existential serenity I thought it might provide. I couldn't. And while I did find something about the unadorned Puritan simplicity of the church to be calming, my visits there didn't really help either, especially during the nadir of my Effexor experience. I'd try to calm my breathing, but then I'd get overwhelmed by claustrophobia and panic and have to rush out of the church. I'd often end up shaking on a park bench, probably looking to passing tourists like a homeless person suffering delirium tremens. Yet again I called Dr. Harvard, and yet again he said, "You're not at a therapeutic level of the Effexor yet. Let's increase the dosage." So I started taking more Effexor, and a few days later my vision blurred and I couldn't urinate. I called Dr. Harvard, and for once he sounded alarmed. "Maybe we'd better get you off the Effexor," he said. But I'd been traumatized by the withdrawal symptoms I'd suffered when I'd stopped taking Paxil, and I told him so. Discontinuation syndrome is now a clinically acknowledged Paxil phenomenon. "I'm giving you a prescription for Celexa," he said, "using the brand name for citalopram, another SSRI. Start taking it right away and continue taking the Xanax." I did. And within a day my vision cleared and my urine again flowed, which would seem to suggest those problems had been side effects of the drug. But they might not have been. The tendency of anxiety sufferers to somaticize, to convert their neuroses into physical symptoms, means it's possible my blurred vision and recalcitrant bladder were simply physical representations of my anxiety. The transition from Effexor to Celexa was smoother than the transition from Paxil to Effexor had been, perhaps because I didn't wean off one before going on the other. But since then, despite chronic and intermittently severe anxiety, I've not gone a day without taking an SSRI antidepressant, and I've not adjusted my dosage much for fear of repeating the Paxil to Effexor experience. At times, I think wistfully about my early days on Paxil, when I found a modicum of relief, and wonder if I shouldn't switch back and try to achieve again that panic-free nirvana. But the clinical research is full of people who return to drugs they had taken earlier, only to find them no longer effective. And in any case, the experience of weaning off Paxil is not one I want to repeat. Medication, medication, medication. What do I got to show for it? The Sopranos' Tony Soprano to Dr. Melfi after a year on Prozac for his panic attacks. Exploding into the national consciousness with the March 26, 1990 edition of Newsweek, whose cover featured a green and white capsule alongside the words, "A breakthrough drug for depression," fluoxetine, under its trade name Prozac, would become the iconic antidepressant of the late 20th century, a blockbuster for its manufacturer, Eli Lilly. The first selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, SSRI, to be released in the United States, Prozac would before long surpass Xanax as the best-selling psychotropic drug in history, even as competing SSRIs, among them Zoloft, Paxil, Celexa, and Lexapro, would soon be on their way to outpacing Prozac. With the possible exception of antibiotics, SSRIs are the most commercially successful class of prescription drugs in history. By 2002, according to one estimate, some 25 million Americans, more than 5% of all men and 11% of all women, were taking an SSRI antidepressant. The numbers have only grown since then. A 2007 estimate put the number of Americans on SSRIs at 33 million. These drugs dominate not only hospital psychiatry and our medicine cabinets, but also our culture and natural environment. Books like Prozac Nation, Prozac Diary, and Listening to Prozac, and of course, Talking Back to Prozac, populated the bestseller lists throughout the 1990s. And Prozac and Lexapro jokes remain a fixture of movies and New Yorker cartoons. Trace elements of Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, and Celexa have been found in the ecosystems of American frogs, causing them developmental delays and anomalies, in the brains and livers of fish in North Texas, and in Lake Mead, America's largest reservoir, which supplies drinking water to Las Vegas, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Phoenix. Given how completely SSRIs have saturated our culture and our environment, you might be surprised to learn that Eli Lilly, which held the U.S. patent for fluoxetine, killed the drug in development 7 times because of unconvincing test results. After examining tepid fluoxetine trial outcomes as well as complaints about the drug's side effects, German regulators in 1984 concluded, "Considering the benefit and the risk, we think this preparation totally unsuitable for the treatment of depression." Early clinical trials of another SSRI, Paxil, were also failures. A series of studies in the 1980s found imipramine, the tricyclic antidepressant, to be more effective than Prozac for treating patients with depression or panic disorder. Imipramine also trounced Paxil in 2 studies in the early 1980s of patients with depression. In 1989, Paxil failed to beat a placebo in more than half its trials, Yet 4 years later, Paxil was approved by the FDA, and by 2000, it was the best-selling antidepressant on the market, outselling Prozac and Zoloft. How did SSRIs go from being considered ineffective to being one of the best-selling drug classes in history? In the answer to that question lies a story about how dramatically our understanding of anxiety and depression has changed in a short period of time. Once again, the story begins at Steve Brody's laboratory at the National Institutes of Health. After leaving Brody's lab for the University of Gothenburg in Sweden in 1959, Arvid Carlsson gave tricyclic antidepressants to mice with artificially depleted serotonin levels. Would the antidepressants boost serotonin levels? Yes. Imipramine had serotonin reuptake inhibiting effects. In the 1960s, Carlsson tried similar experiments with antihistamines. Would they also inhibit the reuptake of serotonin? Again, yes. Carlsson found that an antihistamine called chlorpheniramine had a more powerful and precise effect on the brain's serotonin receptors than did either imipramine or amitriptyline, the two most commonly prescribed tricyclics. Carlsson invoked this finding as evidence to support what he called the serotonin hypothesis of depression. He then set about applying this discovery in pursuit of a more potent antidepressant. This, the medical historian Edward Shorter has written, was the birthing hour of the SSRIs. Carlsson wanted to pursue chlorpheniramine clinical trials for patients with anxiety and depression, but he never did. His own lab research, as well as subsequent naturalistic observations, showed that chlorpheniramine may, without any modifications, be as effective as any existing SSRI, which is intriguing because chlorpheniramine has been on the market, under the trade name chlortrimeton, as an over-the-counter medicine for pollen allergies since 1950. In 2006, Einar Hellbom, a Swedish researcher, published a study suggesting that patients diagnosed with panic disorder who took chlorpheniramine for their hay fever experienced a remission of their panic symptoms while on the drug. When the patients went off chlortrimeton, even if they switched to another antihistamine, many of them found their panic attacks returning. Hellbom suggested that perhaps this means an effective non-prescription SSRI antidepressant is sitting on the allergy remedy shelf of your local pharmacy today, even though scarcely any doctors, and certainly no consumers, are aware of its potential in this regard. If chlorpheniramine had been tested on depression in the 1970s, Hellbom writes, it is probable that a safe, inexpensive SSRI drug could have been used some 15 years earlier than Prozac. Chlorpheniramine might have been the first safe, non-cardiotoxic, and well-tolerated antidepressant. Billions of dollars in the development and marketing costs would have been saved, and the suffering of millions of patients alleviated. This is striking to me because I took chlortrimeton regularly each spring throughout my childhood. I had always attributed the lifting of my depression and anxiety in April and May to the lengthening of the daylight and the approaching end of the school year. But Hellbaum's paper leads me to wonder if my brightening mood and decreasing tension each spring were a result of my exposure to chlortrimeton, the accidental SSRI. Carlsson next experimented with a different antihistamine, bromphenyramine, the active ingredient in the cough medication Dimetapp. It, too, blocked the reuptake of serotonin and norepinephrine more robustly than imipramine did. He modified the antihistamine to create compound H10209, which blocked only the reuptake of serotonin. Working with a team of researchers at Astra, a Swedish pharmaceutical company, Carlsson applied for a patent for H10209, which had by then been renamed zimelidine, on April 28, 1971. Early clinical trials suggested zimelidine had some effectiveness in reducing depression, and in 1982, Astra started selling it in Europe as the antidepressant Zelmid. Astra licensed Zelmid's North American rights to Merck, which began preparing to release the drug in the United States. Then tragedy struck. Some patients taking Zelmid became paralyzed. A few died. Zelmid was pulled from pharmacy shelves in Europe and was never distributed in America. Executives at Eli Lilly watched these developments with interest. Some 10 years earlier, biochemists at the company's labs in Indiana had fiddled with chemical derivatives of a different antihistamine, diphenhydramine, the active ingredient in the allergy medication Benadryl, to create a compound called LY82816, which had a potent effect on serotonin, but only a weak effect on norepinephrine levels. This made LY82816 the most clean or selective of the several compounds the researchers tested. The tricyclics and MAOIs, in contrast, were dirty or non-selective in that they affected not just serotonin, but also norepinephrine, dopamine, and other neurotransmitters, a fact that was thought to account for their wide range of unpleasant side effects. David Wong, an Eli Lilly biochemist, reformulated LY82816 into compound LY110140 and wrote up his findings in the journal Life Sciences in 1974. At this point, Wong would later recall, work on LY110140 was an academic exercise. Nobody knew whether there would be a market for even one serotonin-boosting psychiatric medication, and since Zelmid already had a head start of several years in getting through clinical trials and onto the market, Eli Lilly put LY110140, now called fluoxetine, aside. But when Zelmid started paralyzing people, Eli Lilly executives realized fluoxetine now had a chance to be the first SSRI on the market in America, so they restarted the research machinery. Though many of the early clinical trials were not notably successful, the drug was approved and released in Belgium in 1986. In January 1988, fluoxetine was released in the United States, marketed as the first highly specific, highly potent blocker of serotonin uptake. Eli Lilly gave it the trade name Prozac, which a branding firm had thought had Zap to it. 2 years later, the pill graced the cover of Newsweek. 3 years after that, Peter Kramer, the Brown psychiatrist, published Listening to Prozac. When Listening to Prozac came out in the summer of 1993, I was 23 and on my third tricyclic antidepressant. This time, disipramine, whose trade name is Norpramin. I read the book with fascination, marveling at the transformative effects Prozac had had on Kramer's patients. Many of his patients became, as he put it, better than well. Prozac seemed to give social confidence to the habitually timid, to make the sensitive brash, to lend the introvert the social skills of a salesman. I thought. This sounds pretty good. My longtime psychiatrist, Dr. L., had been suggesting Prozac to me for months. But reading Kramer, I worried about what Faustian exchange was being made here. What got lost, in selfhood or the more idiosyncratic parts of personality, when Prozac medicated away the nervousness or the melancholy? In his book, Kramer concluded forcefully that for most severely anxious or depressed patients, the bargain was worthwhile. But he worried, too, about what he called cosmetic psychopharmacology, the use of psychiatric drugs by normal or healthy people to become happier, more social, more professionally effective. Before long, I joined the millions of other Americans taking SSRIs, and I've been on one or another pretty much continuously for going on 20 years. Nevertheless, I can't say with complete conviction that these drugs have worked, or that they've been worth the costs in terms of money, side effects, drug-switching traumas, and who knows what long-term effects on my brain. After the initial flush of enthusiasm for SSRIs, some of the fears that had surrounded tranquilizers in the 1970s began clustering around antidepressants. It is now clear, David Healy, the historian of psychopharmacology, has written, that the rates at which withdrawal problems have been reported on Paxil exceed the rates at which withdrawal problems have been reported on any other psychotropic drug ever. Ironically, the early commercial success of SSRIs owed a lot to the public furor over Valium addiction in the early 1970s, which had driven benzodiazepines out of favor. When the FDA approved SSRIs for the treatment of depression, that caused the number of depression diagnoses to skyrocket, even as rates of anxiety diagnosis fell. But when the FDA subsequently approved SSRIs for the treatment of anxiety, the number of anxiety diagnoses rose again. Paxil is truly addictive, Frank Berger, the inventor of Milltown, said not long before his death in 2008. If you have somebody on Paxil, it's not so easy to get him off. This is not the case with Librium, Valium, and Milltown. A few years ago, my primary care physician told me she had stopped prescribing Paxil because so many of her patients had reported such severe withdrawal effects. Even leaving aside withdrawal effects, there is now a large pile of evidence suggesting, in line with those early studies of the ineffectiveness of Prozac and Paxil, that SSRIs may not work terribly well. In January 2010, almost exactly 20 years after introducing Americans to SSRIs, Newsweek published a cover story reporting on studies that suggested these drugs are barely as effective as sugar pills for the treatment of anxiety and depression. Two massive studies from 2006 showed most patients do not get better taking antidepressants. Only about a third of the patients in these studies improved dramatically after a first trial. After reviewing dozens of studies on SSRI effectiveness, the British Medical Journal concluded that Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, and the other drugs in the SSRI class do not have a clinically meaningful advantage over placebo. These findings are controversial and continue to be debated fiercely on psychiatry and psychology blogs. How can this be? Tens of millions of Americans, including me and many people I know, collectively consume billions of dollars worth of SSRIs each year. Doesn't this suggest that these drugs are effective? Not necessarily. At the very least, these massive rates of SSRI consumption have not caused rates of self-reported anxiety and depression to go down, and in fact, all this pill-popping seems to correlate with substantially higher rates of anxiety and depression. If you're born around World War I, in your lifetime, the prevalence of depression is about 1%, says Martin Seligman, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania. If you're born around World War II, the lifetime prevalence of depressions seem to be about 5%. If you were born starting in the 1960s, the lifetime prevalence seemed to be between 10% and 15%, and this is with lives incomplete, meaning that in the end, the actual rates will be higher. That's at least a tenfold increase in the diagnosis of depression across just two generations. The same trend is evident in other countries. In Iceland, the incidence of depression nearly doubled between 1976, before the arrival of SSRIs, and 2000. In 1984, 4 years before the introduction of Prozac, Britain reported 38 million days of incapacity, sick days, resulting from depression and anxiety disorders. In 1999, after a decade of widespread SSRI use, Britain attributed 117 million days of incapacity to the same disorders, an increase of 300%. Health surveys in the United States show that the percentage of working-age Americans who reported being disabled by depression tripled in the 1990s. Here's the most striking statistic I've come across. Before antidepressants existed, some 50 to 100 people per million were thought to suffer from depression. Today, between 100,000 and 200,000 people per million are estimated to have depression. In a time when we have more biochemically sophisticated treatments than ever for combating depression, that's a 1,000% increase in the incidence of depression. In his 2010 book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, the journalist Robert Whittaker marshaled evidence suggesting that SSRIs actually cause depression and anxiety, that SSRI consumption over the last 20 years has created organic changes in the brains of tens of millions of drug takers, making them more likely to feel nervous and unhappy. Statistics from the World Health Organization showing that the worldwide suicide rate has increased by 60% over the last 45 years would seem to give weight to the idea that the quotient of unhappiness in the world has risen in tandem with SSRI consumption. Whittaker's argument about drugs causing mental illness is controversial. Most experts would dispute it, and it's certainly not proven. What's clear, though, is that the explosion of SSRI prescriptions has caused a drastic expansion in the definitions of depression and anxiety disorder, as well as more widespread acceptance of using depression and anxiety as excuses for skipping work, which has in turn caused the number of people given these diagnoses to increase. We may look back 150 years from now and see antidepressants as a dangerous and sinister experiment. Joseph Glenmullen, Prozac Backlash, 2001. In America, the question of when and whether to prescribe medications for routine neurotic suffering is bound up with two competing intellectual traditions: our historical roots in the self-denial and asceticism of our Puritan forebears versus the post-baby boom belief that everyone is entitled to the pursuit of happiness enshrined in our founding document. In modern psychiatry, the tension between these two traditions plays out in the battle between Peter Kramer's cosmetic psychopharmacology and what's known as pharmacological Calvinism. Critics of cosmetic psychopharmacology, including to some extent Kramer himself, worry about what happens when millions of mildly neurotic patients seek medication to make themselves better than well, and when competition to get and stay ahead in the workplace creates a pharmaceutical arms race. The term pharmacological Calvinism was coined in 1971 by Gerald Clerman, a self-described angry psychiatrist who was out to combat the emerging consensus that if a drug makes you feel good, it must be bad. Life is hard and suffering is real, Clerman and his allies argued. So why should ill-founded Puritanism be allowed to interfere with nervous or unhappy Americans' quest for peace of mind? The pharmacological Calvinists believe that to escape psychic pain without quest or struggle is to diminish the self or the soul. It's getting something for nothing, a Faustian bargain at odds with the Protestant work ethic. Psychotherapeutically, Clerman wrote sardonically, the world is divided into the first-class citizens, the saints who can achieve their cure or salvation by willpower, insight, psychoanalysis, or by behavior modification, and the rest of the people, who are weak in their moral fiber and need a crutch. Clerman angrily dismissed such concerns, wondering why we would, out of some sense of misguided moral propriety, deny anxious, depressed Americans relief from their suffering and the opportunity to pursue higher, more meaningful goals. Why remain mired in the debilitating self-absorption of your neuroses if a pill can free your mind? Americans are ambivalent about all this. We pop tranquilizers and antidepressants by the billions, yet at the same time, we have historically judged reliance on psychiatric medication to be a sign of weakness or moral failure. Much more so than in, say, France, where tranquilizer consumption rates are higher, but perhaps even less so than in Japan, where SSRI consumption rates are much lower. A study conducted by researchers at the National Institute of Mental Health in the early 1970s concluded that Americans believe tranquilizers are effective, but have serious doubts about the morality of using them. Which sounds like a somewhat illogical and self-contradictory position, but it happens to be the one I hold myself. I reluctantly take both tranquilizers and antidepressants, and I believe that they work, at least a little, at least some of the time. And I acknowledge that, as many psychiatrists and psychopharmacologists have told me, I may have a medical condition that causes my symptoms and somehow justifies the use of these medications. Yet at the same time, I also believe, and I believe that society believes, that my nervous problems are in some way a character issue or a moral failing. I believe my weak nerves make me a coward and a wimp, with all the negative judgment those words imply, which is why I have tried to hide evidence of them, and which is why I worry that resorting to drugs to mitigate these problems both proves and intensifies my moral weakness. "Stop judging yourself," Dr. W. says. "You're making your anxiety worse." He's right. And yet I can't help concurring with the 40% of respondents to that NIMH survey who agreed with the statement, "Moral weakness causes mental illness, and taking tranquilizers to correct or ameliorate the condition is further evidence of that weakness." Of course, as we learn more about how genes encode certain temperamental traits and dispositions into our personalities, it becomes harder to sustain the moral weakness argument in quite the same way. If my genes have encoded in me an anxious physiology, how responsible can I be held for the way that I quiver in the face of frightening situations or tend to crumble under stress? With the evidence for a strong genetic basis to psychiatric disorders accumulating, more recent surveys about American attitudes toward reliance on psychiatric medication reveal a dramatic shift of opinion. In 1996, only 38% of Americans saw depression as a health problem, versus 62% who saw depression as evidence of personal weakness. A decade later, those numbers had more than reversed. 72% saw depression as a health problem, and only 28% saw it as evidence of personal weakness. The serotonin theory of depression is comparable to the masturbatory theory of insanity. David Healy, in a 2002 speech at the Institute of Psychiatry in London. The deeper one digs into the entwined histories of anxiety and psychopharmacology, the clearer it becomes that anxiety has a direct and relatively straightforward biological basis. Anxiety, like all mental states, lives in the interstices of our neurons, in the soup of neurotransmitters that bathes our synapses. Relief from anxiety comes from resetting our nervous thermostats by adjusting the composition of that soup. Perhaps, as Peter Kramer mused in listening to Prozac, what ailed Camus' stranger, his anhedonia, his anomie, was merely a disorder of serotonin. And then one digs a little deeper still, and none of that is very clear at all. Even as advances in neuroscience and molecular genetics have allowed us to get more and more precise in drawing connections between this protein and that brain receptor, or between this neurotransmitter and that emotion, some of the original underpinnings of biological psychiatry have been unraveling. The exaltation of Prozac a quarter century ago created a cult of serotonin as the happiness neurotransmitter. But from the start, some studies were failing to find a statistically significant difference between the serotonin levels of depressed and non-depressed people. One early study of a group of depressed patients reported in Science in 1976 found that only half had atypical levels of serotonin, and only half of those had serotonin levels that were lower than average, meaning that only a quarter of the depressed patients could be considered serotonin deficient. In fact, an equally large number had serotonin levels that were higher than average. Many subsequent studies have produced results that complicate the notion of a consistent relationship between serotonin deficiency and mental illness. Evidently, the correlation between serotonin and anxiety or depression is less straightforward than once thought. None other than the father of the serotonin hypothesis of depression, Arvid Carlsson, has announced that psychiatry must relinquish it. In 2002, at a conference in Montreal, he declared that we must abandon the simplistic hypothesis that a disordered emotion is the result of either an abnormally high or abnormally low function of a given neurotransmitter. Not long ago, George Ashcroft, who as a research psychiatrist in Scotland in the 1960s was one of the scientists responsible for promulgating the chemical imbalance theory of mental illness, renounced the theory when further research failed to support it. In 1998, Elliot Valenstein, a neuroscientist at the University of Michigan, devoted a whole book, Blaming the Brain, to arguing that the evidence does not support any of the biochemical theories of mental illness. We have hunted for big, simple neurochemical explanations for psychological disorders, Kenneth Kendler, the editor-in-chief of Psychological Medicine and a professor of psychiatry at Virginia Commonwealth University, conceded in 2005, and we have not found them. What if the reason we haven't been able to pinpoint how Prozac and Celexa work is that, in fact, they don't work? Psychiatric drugs do more harm than good, says Peter Breggin, the Harvard-trained psychiatrist who is a frequent witness in lawsuits against the drug companies. He's backed up by those studies showing that only about a third of patients get better on antidepressants. But studies have generally not found the response rates to other forms of treatment to be all that much better. And the